So we want to welcome our regular attenders, our guests, and our special guests this morning. As a surprise to me, I want to thank Pastor Bobby Rollerson for sharing some of his congregation with us this morning. As I understand that that church could not meet in several locations because of the storm, I think I understand that correctly. So thank you for coming and joining us with us this morning. We are talking about this morning really a very relevant title. I didn't plan on doing this, but I kind of switched it when Matthew came, and it's trusting in the uncertain versus trusting in the certain. Trusting in the uncertain versus trusting in the certain. Where or to whom do we place our trust? We'll be reading out of Psalms chapter 36, verses 1 through 9. Psalm chapter 36, verses 1 through 9. I was just talking with Patrick in the back before we started here, and he showed me a picture on his phone. I said, "What's this?" And he said, "It's my house." And a tree fell at his house, but it split into two to where it avoided the house. And he said, "How do you not know that God is real and a faithful God and a God that will protect?" Praise God for all the protection that he gave us here in Central Florida and beyond as that storm continued to move up the East Coast. There's still many that we need to pray for as far as recovery and as far as the continued struggles that we may have. And so we're going to do that at the end of the service today. And it often, you know, it really is a litmus test with where we place our trust. When things like this happen, in whom or to what do we place our trust in? So Psalm chapter 36, we'll read this together, beginning in verse 1. "An oracle is within my heart concerning the sinfulness of the wicked. There is no fear of God before his eyes. For in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to detect or hate his sin. The words of his mouth are wicked and deceitful. He has ceased to be wise and to do good." As we read this, as we move on with this sermon today, we're asking ourselves, you know, why do we place our trust in the uncertainties of life? And so we're going to get to the root cause of that in this passage, and then why we should place our trust in God. Verse 4, "Even on his bed he plots evil. He commits himself to a sinful course and does not reject what is wrong." And then he transitions. The psalmist David here transitions in verse 5. He transitions from our sinful nature and our sinful condition to God and the attributes of God. He says in verse 5, "Your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens. Your faithfulness to the skies." So while we don't know what love is because of our sinful nature, while we put our trust in uncertainties and things that don't prove faithful in our life, you, God, are love. You, God, are faithful. Verse 6, "Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains, your justice like the great deep. O Lord, you preserve both man and beast. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men find refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light." Some examples of uncertainties in my life. I don't know about yours, but one for me is gas prices. And I have a problem with this. I never want to get ripped off with gas. And so when I go to a gas station and it's a little too high, I believe, but I've got to get gas because I'm out, I'll stop by and I've got to get gas. I've got to get it in my car so I can get to my destination. So I don't fill it up, though, because I don't want them to beat me. So I want to beat them at their own game. So I'll get about $10 worth of gas. And I hate that because $10 runs out pretty quickly. And then I've got to stop again. I don't like stopping for gas, so I'll go until it says 0 miles left in my car, but I know I've got a little bit more left in the tank. And so I'll continue to go. My wife hates this. I'll run on fumes, and then I'll finally stop again. But if I feel like it's too high, I cannot fill up my tank. I'll get about $10. And then it causes me to stop again and again. So finally, I've come to a conclusion that, and also to get out of the doghouse, "Nathan, just fill it up. Just who cares? Just fill it up." So I tried to apply that this past week before Matthew, and I go to our little gas station right over here in Bonneville, and they're completely out of gas. So I've got all kinds of issues at this point. You cannot trust in gas prices, that's for sure. What's going to happen when the election rolls around here the next few weeks? Can't believe I'm saying that, but few weeks. What's going to happen to our gas prices? What happens when hurricanes come and these types of things? You can't trust in that. Now, can we talk about college football just for a second? Speaking of hurricanes, last week I placed my trust in my Seminoles and they let me down. But this week, they would not let a hurricane get to them. And so if you watch college football at all this year, you know that every second counts. Ask those that are cheering for Tennessee versus Georgia last week, every second counts. Or maybe the Seminole game, every second counts. And a field goal kicker, could he possibly kick a 54-yarder when he never has in his life in a game? Sure he will. And he does. And so last night with the hurricane game, the field goal kicker, I think, has made something 60 or 70 straight extra points. And so you know that it's a guarantee he's going to make a simple extra point. He doesn't. Now, it happens to be in our favor today. If you're a Seminole fan, if you're a Hurricane fan, you're kind of hurting this morning. But we learned that in sports, and we do this far too often, we cannot place our trust in our team because they may let us down. Now, on a serious note, many of us, we're looking towards our government and for all kinds of things, and that our government is a certain thing, and we know that it's not. Or promises that are made to us, that promise coming from this person, it may be a pastor, it may be a teacher, it may be a coach, it may be the best of friends. When they make a promise, they will not let me down. But they are human like us. And they will let you down at some point. We can't trust in even that. Some place their trust in other religions beyond Christianity. And they're saying that I'm going to put my eternity on the line. That my entire belief system will be rooted in this, this, or that. Maybe because they were raised that way. Maybe for some reason they were influenced that way. And they will find out one day, if they haven't already, that that religion centered around a false god or belief system will let them down, especially when it comes to the things of eternity. And so for some reason, though, we find ourselves trusting in the uncertainties of life when God, the only certain, seems to be our last resort. Why do we do that? In Psalm chapter 36, David addresses what I believe is the root cause of why we place our trust in the uncertainties of life and why we don't place it in the only certain. And then, as we read earlier, he transitions from our sinful nature to the attributes of God. And so it's possible that David penned this psalm after he was struck at by Saul or by Absalom. Or possibly he could be describing his culture as a whole. And David writing this psalm in an effort to expose the culture that they are trusting in these uncertainties, in themselves, trusting in their own ways. And it's leading up to a covering up of sin, a lack of seriousness towards sin, towards a reverence of God. And that moves us down a path that is not good, because we continue to trust in the things that are uncertain. And so, trusting in the uncertain, verse 1 through 4, let me repeat. An oracle is within my heart concerning the sinfulness of the wicked. There is no fear of God before his eyes. You see that this culture, and ours, has lost their reverence for God. We've lost our reverence for God. And we've talked about this a few Sundays ago. They've lost their God-sized respect. To put it bluntly, they thought of themselves as being bigger than God. Because when we don't trust in Him, when we trust in ourselves, we're in fact saying that we are God. And so we're trusting in ourselves because we've placed ourselves now above God. And therefore, why should we fear Him? He's lower than ourselves. We should only fear ourselves because we are greater than God. David continues in verse 2, for his own eyes he flatters himself too much to detect or hate his sin. Now, the more that we elevate ourselves, especially surpassing God, the more we move away from God. The more we surpass God, the more we feel that we're greater than God. The more that we move away from God, the more that we accept sin, the more that we accept our own sin, the more that we twist truth, bury sin, cover up sin, find ourselves loving sin and hiding sin. The progression of sin, the snowball of sin. Have you been there? I've been there before. I've been a part of a group of guys that were diving into God's Word and pretty serious about the things of God. And this is in my college days. And all of a sudden, we found ourselves drifting away from our purpose to seeking God as a group. And then all of a sudden, we begin to accept things that each other was doing, where at one point, we wouldn't call, you know, we would almost call ourselves and call each other out on certain things that we got caught up in that weren't of God to keep ourselves on the right path, to keep ourselves straight. But instead of that, we found ourselves sort of accepting it. And then over time, we're actually laughing about it. And as a group, we moved more and more and more away from God. We lost our accountability. And when I read this passage about laughing about sin and flattering ourselves to a point where we don't even detect that we're caught up in sin, I think about those memories and want to make sure that I don't get caught up in that again. How about you? That I want people around me to be cheering me on with true accountability towards the things of God so we don't get caught in Satan's trap. Verse 3, the words of his mouth are wicked and deceitful. He has ceased to be wise and to do good. Verse 4, even on his bed he plots evil. He commits himself to a sinful course and does not reject what is wrong. Now, when we read a progression of sin like this, kind of a snowball of sin, we put ourselves in that situation and we say, there is no way we are that bad. We would not get caught in a situation like this to where we're actually plotting out wicked things or plotting out evil things. But you know, and the psalmist knows, that when we begin to place ourselves above God, when we begin to accept sin in our lives and begin to cover it up, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves following after where Satan's leading, there's no telling what we might do. And so we must have true accountability surrounding us so we don't get caught in the right path. Romans 3:18 says this, because of our sin nature, there is no fear of God before our eyes. That is a very dangerous spot to be in when we lose our reverent fear for Almighty God. And we do that when we place ourselves higher than God. And when we place ourselves higher than God, we are at a very dangerous point. The devil wants us to be there. We're at a very dangerous point. And so back in David's time, there was no fear of God before their eyes. But in our time today, you could argue pretty easily that as a country, there's no fear of God before our eyes. And so what is the root of why we trust in the uncertainties of life? It's because we're placing ourselves above God. We're placing ourselves ahead of God. We live like we don't need God. And the implication of that is that we would rather trust ourselves. We would rather trust man-made ideas. We would rather trust man-made strategies. It almost seems laughable, but it's true. We would rather trust all the things that are uncertain rather than trust the only certainty in our world. The root cause is we're born into that sinful condition. And if we follow that sinful condition and not fight against it, we're going to find ourselves in the same spot, losing our reverent fear of God, moving past God, moving ahead of God, trusting ourselves instead of God, and finding ourselves in a world of trouble. So when you face the storms in life, where are you going to put your trust? When you look back at your life, where have you put your trust. Whether it's a literal storm like Matthew, where it's a literal case study about where we place our trust and where we turn to when literal hurricanes come our way, or whether it's the storms of life. My wife and I know a family who lost their 5-year-old to brain cancer. And this is several years back. And you think as a parent, dear God, take me before my kids. Dear God, give me cancer before you would give my kid cancer. And we're walking with this family still through this. This is years later. You talk about a storm in life. How can I trust the God who allowed my 5-year-old to die of brain cancer? How do you navigate through that? If something like that was to happen to you, and all of us could stand up and describe very difficult times that have come our way. Like we said last week, we're either just coming out of a difficult time, we're in one, or one's on the horizon. And so we could all share our stories. So in the midst of the depths of these difficult times, where do we place our trust? Are we going to continue to trust in the uncertainties that let us down every time? Or are we going to trust in the only certainty of life? My wife Amber is reading a book she just finished from Ann Voskamp entitled 1,000 Gifts. And there's a quote in this book that kind of rocked our world. And so I'm going to try to rock yours. When it comes down to who do we trust, if we're to get very practical and very real, here's what Ann Voskamp said. She says, anything less than gratitude and trust in God is practical atheism. And we went, let's read that again. Anything less than gratitude and trust in God is practical atheism. Wait a second. I believe in God. I'm not an atheist. I believe there is a God. I believe in the one true God. But when it counts, do I really believe in him? If you don't, you may be a practical atheist. Do you see how that rocked our world? So basically what Anne is saying here is the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is actually unbelief. There are times when we act like atheists because we don't really believe that God is there. My family and I this last year have tried to put that thought to a test. As we've taken this faith journey as a family to jump all in, say, God, we've been preaching about it for decades. But as a family, we're going to put ourselves out there. And you know, and everyone here knows, our journey that God has been there day after day and week after week. And you could say the same thing when you take a faith step for him and he's confirmed that direction. You leap in after him. He may not show you the whole plan. He may not show you the whole puzzle, but that piece is the right piece. And you take it and you put it to where it needs to be. Because Amber and I have said, if this faith journey, we don't know exactly where it's going to take us, but what we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, at the end of our life, we could say at that moment in our life, we jumped in with everything that we are. And I've heard story after story of other people doing the same thing, jumping all in, not just talking about it, not just preaching about it, but doing it so that we could therefore say, God, that we truly believe in your provision. We truly believe in who you say you are. We truly believe in your character. And let's move into that, because David expresses why God is our only certainty in the second part of this passage this morning. He moves from our sinful condition and getting caught up in the snowball of sin to why we should place our trust in the only certain, the God of the Bible. He says this in verse 5, your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains, your justice like the great deep. O Lord, you preserve both man and beast. How priceless then is your unfailing love, a love that does not fail. Both high and low among men find refuge in the shadow of your wings. Patrick, you found refuge in God, didn't you? As the tree fell, it split into two to avoid your house. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delight. He's our great provider. And finally in verse 9, for with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light. David reveals that God is love. David reveals that God is faithful. Now this is the certainty that we can place our eternity on the line as well as our day-to-day. He's love, he's faithful, he's sovereign, he's righteous, he's holy. God is the sustainer of life. God is our protector. God is the provider of blessing. God provides, ultimately, salvation. And so in this passage, we find many attributes of God that validate why he is the only certain that we can trust. Why the things of him are a guarantee. Why we can and should place our full trust in him. So it wouldn't be said of us that we are practical atheists. We're going to focus on four of these attributes and conclude that God is our only certainty. And we need to walk away thanking him for this, praising him for this, and actually trusting him with all that we are. We don't know what today's going to bring us. And we don't know what tomorrow's going to bring us. We don't know what this week is going to bring us. We don't know if Matthew's going to circle back around and come back, or another hurricane coming along, or a storm in your life that may be coming your way that you have no idea. Let's commit today that we are going to, with everything that we are, put our trust in the certain things of God. Ultimately, our trust in him. And walk out today, not knowing our future, but knowing who holds our future, praising the Lord. Attribute number one, God is love. God is love. A description for God 697 times. We find in Ephesians chapter 3 that God's love surpasses our understanding. Paul prays that the Ephesian church would begin to grasp God's love for them. He prays for them as if he was praying for us today here at University Baptist Churches and other churches across the world today. Ephesians 3, beginning of the second part of verse 17, Paul says, "And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love." I love that word rooted. I think about the trees, that the oak trees that have just, with shallow roots, that have just come up in this storm. I think about this being rooted, being deep rooted, more like a pine tree that may snap in half, but the roots are not going to come up. You are deeply rooted and established in what? In God's love. They have power together with all the saints to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. I picture Paul praying over us today and other churches across the world that we would get to know this God with this love. Who else's love surpasses our understanding? And then we see about God's love that God proved his unconditional love, of course, on the cross. In 1 John chapter 4, verse 9 and 10, I love these couple of verses here. This is how God showed his love among us. Now, when we compare the God of the Bible to other gods, we serve the only God that demonstrated his love. We serve the only God that proved his love. We serve the only God that actually showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. Verse 10 says, this is love, not that we loved God, but that he actually loved us. In the midst of our sinful condition, in the midst of our hearts being born into the sin condition, running away from God, in the midst of rejection, in the midst of all of this, this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. And so therefore, verse 19, we love only because he first loved us. Who else has proven his love that is not based on conditions, that's not based on performance? Only the God of the Bible, only the certain in this world. Lastly, in relation to love and about love, the application of God's love aligns us with Jesus. We've talked about this in the last couple of weeks. In John 13, 34 and 35, Jesus says to his disciples, "A new command I give you to love one another." A new command I give you to love one another. And Jesus was so good. Because do you see his attention getter? He's talking to his disciples. He said, "I give you a new command." Okay, let's get the new command from Jesus to love one another. Wait a second, Jesus. I don't think that's a new command. What are you talking about? That's a new command. So Jesus was setting up what he was about to say. "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you." Okay, now we're starting to get it. Although they wouldn't get it back then because Jesus didn't take it to the cross yet. But now looking back, we get it. We get more of the bigger picture, the larger picture, that he knows he's going to take it to the cross. "So as I have loved you," which is completely based on no conditions, not performance at all, complete unconditional love. "As I have loved you, so you must love one another." And then the next part of this verse makes sense. That if you love others with that type of unconditional love, if you love others the way I have loved you, that's not based on performance. How many times do we love others based on what they do for us? Jesus said even to love your enemies. How are we going to love our enemies with our love? We can't do that because our love is based on condition. It's conditional. But when we love our enemies, when we love others based on the love that he loved us with, which is completely unconditional, verse 35 then says, "By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you simply love one another."